Welcome to Real Vision. It's Monday, October 12th, 2020. It's a holiday here in New York. We're filming the Friday before. I'm here today with Ed Harrison. Welcome, Ed.
Good to be here, even though it's actually not the Monday, but the Friday. It's great to talk to you, as usual, Ash.
It's always good to talk to you here through the magic of television, coming to you on Monday afternoon.
Yeah, actually, you know, the Real Vision Daily Briefing is one of my favorites. It's the favorite time because we can just talk. In this particular time where we're answering questions from viewers, I think is one of my favorites to do for the Daily Briefing, because I like interacting with the viewers and the parts of our community that we don't get a chance to interact with all the time. We're going to give some shout outs, I think, to individual people who have talked to us and have, you know, really said stuff that's resonated with us. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's always fun. This is the best hour of my day. And I like the AMAs as well, because we get to talk a little bit more about stuff that we often don't get to cover.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, the markets and so forth. And sometimes, you know, the Premier League for you, Ash, we talk about that all the time, but we don't get to talk about, you know, what's going on in terms of, you know, how we're seeing things on a more personal basis, what's going on the platform, that kind of stuff.
Yes. And with that, Ed, I pass the baton to you. What are we talking about this morning?
Yeah, you know, so I think let me look at some of these questions that we have. One question, the first question I see for this Ask Me Anything is from Mark Jackson. He's saying, Ash, Ed, what are you guys personally invested in and over what time horizon? And someone asked, how active are you in the markets? That's Eunice Manton. I don't really want to talk about my own personal investments on a broad global sense. Just because they're my personal investments. But I think I do want to make some thoughts just as a Real Vision user, as a Real Vision subscriber, not as a Real Vision employee. One of the things that I find really great about Real Vision is it exposes me to new and different things, new and different ideas. And I think there are two places in terms of investing that I'm thinking about getting more into that I wouldn't if I weren't a Real Vision subscriber. And they are the cannabis market and the crypto market. I'll tell you two reasons why. I mean, we cover crypto a lot. And I saw the interview that that Rao did that people really liked, that came out on two Fridays ago with the guy who is, he's invested his treasury in crypto instead of in cash. And he walked through why that makes sense. And yeah, things like, yeah, exactly. Things like that are making me think a lot more about crypto as a investment vehicle in this era of negative real interest rates. I don't think that I would be thinking about crypto as much if it weren't something that we feature prominently on the platform. The second is, I saw an interview. It was actually Haley Drasnan's first interview, a full-length interview on the platform, with a guy who is invested in the cannabis space. I'm not thinking about the cannabis space at all. Okay, even though my cousin Todd Harrison has been on the platform many times in the past talking about cannabis, I really hadn't thought about it. But for the first time, Ash, I am now thinking, interesting. This is an interesting vehicle that he's talking about. He talked to me in numbers terms, in terms of EBITDA. He talked about multiples, you know, low multiples. These are things that make my eyes light up from a value investing perspective. So I think that those are two things that I can talk about in terms of my overall investment portfolio.
Yeah. Well, Ed, first of all, welcome to the dark side on crypto. It's good to have you here. I don't know, many people in the audience may not know, but you're a very technically sophisticated guy. You run your own website. You have a lot of background in technology, and it's going to be fun to have you to talk about this. You're going to have to jump on the crypto platform as well from time to time to give us your thoughts, what you're thinking about it as a classic macro investor, and how that world looks to you. I think would be really interesting to hear about. On the cannabis side, Unlike many of the residents of my building, I am not a cannabis user. I smell it when I walk down the hall. I feel like it was 2019. There was this massive shift in New York City last year where you just couldn't walk down the street without walking through clouds of cannabis smoke. So it's definitely an interesting time for me. I think it's an interesting story on the economic and financial side, on the social side. There's just a lot that's happening in that space, and it's intriguing to me. I don't know as much about it as I'd like, but it's something that I'd like to learn more about in the years to come.
You know, let me, when you say that, let me tell you a personal story on that, because I think that in the interview that we had, you know, that Haley did with Jonathan Sandelman, he said something that really resonated with me, because, you know, he was talking about the recreational side, which is what you were talking about. He was also talking about the medicinal side. And how, you know, they're two sides of the same coin in terms of the space. My mother, you know, she suffers from arthritis, and she's also a teetotaler. She really never drinks alcohol or has never had alcohol, never smoked cigarettes, anything, right? So she's just a straight arrow. But, you know, we talked to her, and she's open to the whole concept of medical marijuana because of the medicinal impact that it could potentially have. So I think that it's a space that I'm interested in, and I certainly want to, I would like to see more content on Real Vision with regard to that. And not only interested in it, you know, from a personal perspective, as I was just saying now, but from an investment perspective as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The hesitancy or fear around medical marijuana seems to be largely disappearing from the country. I know that there's some states that still don't allow it or regulate it, but there seems to be a universal consensus at this point amongst voters that if people have medical problems and they can get some relief from cannabis or cannabis-related products, they should absolutely have it. And the third prong, actually, Ed, is there's industrial usage of hemp plants, which have some tremendous environmental potential to eliminate some less environmentally friendly products. It's going to be a huge industry, it seems, by virtually every metric. Ed, here's another question to you from Sunny Singh. It's a very sophisticated question. It's kind of long, so I'm going to paraphrase of it. The substance here is basically, Ed, why have we not seen a seasonal liquidity crisis?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I don't have the answer because no one knows what happened with the repo markets. It's still somewhat controversial what happened last year. And if you remember, Ash, there was a whole thing where the repo markets, in terms of the price that you were paying in the repo markets, just went sky high. And people looked at that as a liquidity crisis. JP Morgan was involved in that. Jamie Dimon was talking about the whole thing. The long and short for me, however, is that it's because we're in a new regime of excess reserves and also other ancillary, what I would call regulatory hurdles. Normally what happens is that you don't have a ton of excess reserves in the system. And as a result, when you have interest rates for borrowing money, what you're able to do in the overnight rate for interest is the Fed sets the rate for overnight money. And as a result of that, setting that rate, that's the rate that prevails, because you need, if people need to borrow reserves, then they're going to borrow it at that rate, because there's always someone who needs to borrow the reserves. But now we're awash in reserves. There's tons of excess reserves. So the natural rate of reserves falls to zero. And so the Fed has to therefore pay interest on reserves in order to get the rate off the zero lower bound, which they had done up to 2.25%, I think it was, before we went back down to zero. So long story short, that's a whole new regime, this whole thing of massive liquidity of excess reserves that started with the great financial crisis. At some point in time, we didn't realize it, that the amount of excess reserves actually wasn't as excess as we thought, because there were all sorts of secondary and tertiary regulatory hurdles on what the really global financial institutions could do. And so what we thought of at a minimum being excess reserves on a primary basis weren't really excess. They were needed for other purposes, other regulatory purposes, et cetera. by these financial institutions. So we actually, I think, got to a hard stop, a point where there really weren't excess reserves in the system. And that's why we had the repo crisis. The Fed has therefore understood that this is the case, that there that really there was a liquidity crisis there, that there weren't as many excess reserves in the system as they thought. And so they've worked to make sure that there were enough excess reserves in the system, and the repo problem has dissipated. So I think that it's because the Fed got on top of the problem that we're not seeing it crop up again. That's my long-winded way of answering your question. I hope that it answers your question.
Yeah, that's exactly right and very well said. I would only add, and for those who aren't following this as closely as Ed Harrison is, if you're relatively new to investing, the interbank lending market, the repo market, absolutely crucial to the plumbing of the financial system.
Exactly. So now it's my time to get back at you, Ash, and let's go to the next question, which is from Lisa G. And she says, "Hi, Ash. You mentioned you used to work at CoinDesk. So aside from that, would you mind sharing the go-to crypto sites that you scan daily for the latest developments?" Unrelated, soccer. I like that. Is that the game with the orange ball?
I think that's the game with the orange ball. That's about the extent of my knowledge. It's a great question. Yes, I used to work at CoinDesk. I actually was the markets editor there, or markets senior markets lead. I forget what the title was exactly. But I was the first reporter in the country, I believe, to cover cryptocurrency as an asset class as a full-time job. That was back in 2017. It's interesting to reflect back on the fact that that job is so recent. And now my good buddy Lawrence Lewitin runs that at CoinDesk. He's the managing editor of markets, I think, there. He got the better title. And he does a great job with it. And I think CoinDesk does a great job. So that's usually my first go-to site. The second one is Cointelegraph, which is something that I regularly view. It's usually my backup to CoinDesk. But interestingly enough, Ed, and this kind of gets to this intergenerational shift in the way that people think about consuming content. You know, when you and I were the young guys on Wall Street in the late 90s and the early 2000s, we probably both remember the guys who would read the Wall Street Journal at their desk on paper. And it looked so interesting. It was like, dude, what are you doing, man? It's all available online now. No, but I like reading it that way. And it's interesting to me because, kind of in keeping with the spirit of cryptocurrency, that a lot of the people who are really involved in the space aren't going to websites as much as you and I do when we think about news. They're on Telegram. They're on Twitter constantly. They're on Steemit and other websites. So it's interesting. It is very much being decentralized in the way that people consume information. For those of you who aren't familiar with Telegram is an almost Twitter-like application where users can post short little squibs of data. They can form groups. You can interchange information that way. And Steemit, in many senses, is kind of like the Reddit of crypto. So I think those are interesting places to start. They can be a little intimidating if you're relatively new to the space, but dive in and give it a shot. It's fun. It's interesting. And it's a good way to feel like you are very much in the stream of what's happening.
Interesting. Very interesting. You know, I have a second question for you. I know that you're not going to answer this question per se, but I think it's interesting. So I'm going to go right to it. It's from Sam Colt. He says, "I'd love to know what public football club Ash likes the most stonks-wise." So he's talking about, you know, the athletic clubs that are traded publicly. Which ones do you like? And he has a bunch of questions about, you know, Italian clubs, you know, Liverpool, et cetera, and so forth. But before you answer anything about the question, I think this goes to content, honestly, on Real Vision, because, you know, we've talked about financial markets a lot. I think we actually had an interview with a guy who's the owner of Roma, the club Roma. He's an American guy who's based in Boston. And we really need to broaden the palette in terms of the number of things that we talk about that are not specifically financial markets related. I'd love to have us have more interviews on platform about the economics of sports, because to me, that's fascinating, especially when you think about this. You know, you were talking to me, you sent me a video clip, Ash, that said, these two guys were at a pub and they were talking. You know what I think is really interesting is when you get relegated, when you're the worst team in the Premier League, you go down to another league called the Championship. That sounds pretty good. I'd like to be relegated to the Championship. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, actually, if you think about it, that it doesn't work that way in American sports. In American sports, if you're the worst team in the league, you come back again to the same league. You don't get relegated. You know, if the Boston Red Sox, who finished almost at the bottom of their division this year, my team in baseball, if they were playing in the Premier League, they'd be relegated to AAA baseball. But that doesn't happen. So why is that? And what are the economics behind that? I think that that's a fascinating question.
Yeah, it's incredibly interesting, and also interesting that American society, American culture, are the most competitive in the world, or at least we like to think of ourselves that way. And it doesn't matter how much you lose in any of the major sports leagues here in the United States, you never get relegated. That concept, that term, completely alien to Americans.
Yeah, I really like the concept of you know, hey, if you don't perform, you go down. And some of these teams, they go down one, two notches, three notches. It's really unbelievable to see. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about in the German league, Kaiserslautern. They won the league back in the mid-90s. Where are they now? I mean, they're terrible. It's amazing.
Yeah. I would also add ALDS tied up.
Yeah.
You know, look, it's interesting also to see the what it does for the fans and the amount of skin that they have in the game. There's a terrific series on Netflix called Sunderland Till I Die about the, and I don't want to get this wrong, but I believe it's the Northern England team of Sunderland. And it's the story of what happens to a community when your club gets relegated. And it's devastating. It's just devastating to people. It has a huge psychological impact on a town, on a region. And then the flip side of the coin is when you get promotion, when you get a promotion, which is the opposite of relegation, when you get promoted a league, like the level of joy and euphoria that fans experience, something we just don't have any experience with in the U.S.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you talk to the psychological side, but, you know, I'm again thinking about the financial side. Do you know how much money that team suddenly, because of TV rights and things like that, gets? I mean, if Sunderland isn't in the Premier League, that's just catastrophic from a financial perspective for them, because no one, relatively speaking, follows the Championship outside of the UK. You know, the second league, no one cares.
Right. Yeah. Except for the people who are trying to escape it via promotion that season, right?
Right.
That's the big story. So, Ed, what else are we looking at this morning?
Well, actually, it's back at you again, Ash, with a question for you. How do I get a darn houseplant to Ash? That's from Sean Jay.
Well, Sean, this is an interesting question because it's official. I am now moving. I'm making the shortest move in the history of my life. I am moving 5.5 feet. To the right. Literally, I'm moving directly across the hall in January. Like, so 5.5 feet, that's west toward the park. Maybe we'll get a house plant once I get into my new digs.
Yeah. So you're upgrading within the same building. Are you going to be doing the move all by yourself, or are you going to be hiring a company since you're only moving, like, you know, 20 feet maximum total?
I'm gonna talk to the guys who work at the desk, talk to the porters in the building, and see if I can give them a couple of bucks to help me drag my bed across the hall.
Excellent.
Next question's back to you, Ed, from Daniel Honan. 22% of all USD was created in 2020. Where does the productivity / proof of work side of the equation come into play? Is this an egregious amount of time theft perpetrated on U.S. citizens and global citizens more broadly? And lastly, how will this affect people who deal in the real economy, not the financial economy?
Yeah, interesting question. I'm not sure I understand it fully, but let me answer how I understand it. When you talk about U.S. dollars being created, I'm thinking first and foremost about things like quantitative easing. I'm thinking about the monetary base, the fact that you know, the monetary base was $800 billion right before the great financial crisis. And now it's, you know, something like $7 trillion or probably even more. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the last numbers. But the point being that it's a lot greater than it was. We've had a massive increase in the monetary base, and specifically in the last year. So the question is what does that mean in terms of time value of money? What does it mean about the financial economy versus the real economy? For me, I think the first question has to do with what I would say is thinking about how that money gets into the economy. There are two things about that. Number one is that there's a concept called endogenous money we've talked about many times. The Bank of England talks about this famously, finally, you know, sharing with other people that actually the way that you read in economics textbooks is not the way that the economy works. That, you know, when you create a loan, you're actually creating money because you simultaneously create a deposit. So in our economy, banks, that is private banks, not the central bank, they create the majority of the money. So when we talk about the broad money stock, you know, M2, M3, things of that nature, MZM, we're talking about money that's being created in the financial system endogenously through the process of credit creation by private financial actors. And that money that's created is a multiple of the money that the central bank is creating. So whatever the central bank is doing is not as important as what these guys are doing. So think of it as like this little sliver here, and then a massive amount more of this sliver. So when you think about the dichotomy between the financial economy and the real economy, I think that matters, because when people talk about the velocity of money, what they're essentially talking about is the ability for that creation at the base level to work its way into the financial system. They're almost talking about this difference between the central bank money creation and the money creation here at this level. So just because the central bank at the base level is creating a lot of money doesn't mean that this much larger sliver, it's a one-for-one translation. You, in a bad economy, the velocity of money goes down. And it goes down largely because you know, you have bad debts, because you don't have as many creditworthy borrowers. People don't want to borrow money. People don't want to lend money. And so ultimately, the money that the central bank is creating goes towards asset prices, asset price inflation, and it doesn't necessarily lead to any sort of real economy of benefits. So when people talk about the central bank pumping up financial assets and not helping the real economy, I think that's what they're talking about, exactly that.
Yeah, and this speaks to the very core of the fractional reserve banking system, reserve requirements, and other regulatory requirements that control the amount of money creation relative to the endogenous money supply. And, you know, I've got the chart up right here. The monetary base looks like it hit about $5.2 trillion and rolled over a little bit now to $4.8 trillion in August of 2020.
And I said $7 trillion. So you can see in my mind, I'm thinking that they're going even higher. Ash, you know, when we started the show, I was saying that I wanted to talk and call out people specifically who have had an impact on how I'm thinking about things. You know, as you know, we're thinking about, I mean, in terms of the content group, I think that we are now at the point where we have a steady stream of good content. I think that, you know, the likes of Jeff Gundlach, which is on the platform today as we speak, it won't be, he'll be the next to last interview when this comes out. Those are great interviews, and I'm glad that we're able to see it. But in some ways, we have an embarrassment of riches in terms of the amount of content that we have. We have more content on the platform than ever before. And, you know, that's a double-edged sword in certain ways. And there was a viewer who sent who had a comment in one of our on one of our videos talking about the embarrassment of riches. But he looked at it almost in a negative way. And it's something that we think about on an ongoing basis. So let me paraphrase what he said. Let me read out what he said exactly. Here's what he said. He said, There's too much content on RV at the minute. Less is more. Just looking at average likes, dislikes on videos, way down on what it used to be. Give people too much choice, and what ends up happening is you end up watching nothing. Now, that was a controversial comment, but to me, honestly, it resonates in terms of what we're facing, in terms of how we're thinking about Real Vision going forward. There is a lot of content. There is more content than there used to be. And that's good, but it also can be bad in the sense that, you know, people used to be able to watch everything that's on the platform. Now they can't. And I'd like to know what viewers, I mean, this is the most important part of this particular AMA for me, is I want to know what viewers think about the fire hose of content that they're receiving. Do they like that? Or do they not like it? And if they don't like it, why? What do they think we could do differently than we're doing right now?
Interesting comment. Got us really thinking about it. You know, for me, and I think for most of the editorial team at Real Vision, we were all subscribers first before we were Real Vision employees. So it's something that we think about a great deal of. And, speaking strictly for myself here, I used to watch every minute of content on the Real Vision platform. Every week I watched every minute. And the content now is there's so much of it, and there's so much more that I wish, in a world of without time constraints, without responsibilities, I'd spend 20 hours a week watching Real Vision. But it's a challenge. I don't have the time. It's an incredibly high quality problem to have. But I'm curious if anyone else feels that way. If you feel like you wish you could watch all the content, which isn't to say that we're going to, you know, do anything in terms of dramatically scaling it back. That's not the plan. We've been going in the opposite direction. But I'm curious if it's something that you would like to do in an ideal world, if you'd like to watch all the content, I think, as I did and as you did, I think, Ed.
Yeah, and there are two questions that follow on to that for me. One is about curation. To the degree that you're saying that in that way, Ash, the question is if we were to curate content so that, because you can't watch everything, how would you want it to be curated? Yeah. We now have an editor's choice list as the second thing that you see. So this is one form of curation. What other suggestions might you have? Another follow-on to that, I think, affects you specifically, Ash. That's the crypto content. And yeah, the way that I'm thinking about it mentally is cross-pollination. That is that crypto is a standalone tier. You can opt into the crypto tier. You don't have to be a part of that. So you don't necessarily have to see any crypto. But I look at, as I was saying earlier in the program, because of crypto on Real Vision, I increasingly look at that space from a financial investment perspective in a way that I probably wouldn't have otherwise. The question, therefore, is how do you cross-pollinate between the Real Vision Classic information and the crypto tier? People who are just consuming crypto, they should actually get some sort of cross-pollination from Real Vision Classic. And I think that the same is true in reverse. If you're not a part of the crypto tier, in the past, you did get some crypto information here and there. I mean, it wasn't a ton. It wasn't overwhelming. But, once every week, once every 2 weeks. So my question to people is what do they see in terms of that cross-pollination? What do they want in terms of that cross-pollination?
Yeah, I think in the broadest sense, that's really the key question is, what would you like to see? How would you like us to arrange the content? What's your wish list look like if you were put in charge of the Real Vision product? How would you like things arranged? How would you like things curated? What can we do to help you consume all of the information that's on the platform in a way that works best for you?
Yeah, well said. So, I mean, those are the questions that we're thinking about on a daily basis as part of the content group here at Real Vision, and we definitely want to hear what you have to say. Let me just switch tack for a really quick second here, Ash, and what I want to talk about my thesis for 1 second of September October timeframe, because yeah. I mentioned this in the comments, but I never really got a chance to really go on to it. So we're at the September October timeframe right now. For the last 3 months, I've been saying the recession is over. I wrote a post on credit write downs in June saying the recession's over. Now we're in the recovery, but September, October is sort of a pivotal moment. We'll have to find out whether or not the recovery is self-sustaining over the longer term, and we'll find out in that time frame. What I was also saying is that there's going to be a lot of volatility as we start to see this. And the reason that this time frame is important is because we will have been out of the we will have recovered, if you will. We will have been out of the lockdown long enough to start to see earnings estimates that are real and economic estimates that are based on a long-term trajectory. We'll have much more visibility. So we had that that volatility associated with this visibility in September. So you saw markets sell off in early September. The NASDAQ actually entered a correction more than 10% down. But you know, all of the price action I've seen with regard to both stocks and junk bonds, and actually, interestingly enough, Ash, also you know, in the commodity space, copper is an example. Copper is trading at levels that are near 52-week highs relative to where it was in March. Not all of this speaks to me of that we're actually getting through this period pretty well. So even though we're in the middle of this period, we're, you know, we still have another, when this video comes out, another 19 days before the October is over. I don't really see any more downside of the sort that we saw in September. I could be wrong, but I'm now looking forward to the next potential period that we have in terms of how we're thinking about where there could be downside risk, where there could be increased volatility, et cetera. And I don't see it, but the precursors are there in two different places that I'm thinking about. One, I'm looking at consumption slash jobless claims. Jobless claims have hovered at a level that I think is pernicious, you know, in the 900, 800,000 level. They could go up. If they did go up from this point, that would be a negative sign in terms of consumption. It would say that so many people are being laid off on a regular basis that it has to have a consumption pullback problem. And then secondly, I think most recessions, usually there's a canary in the coal mine. This last recession wasn't there in terms of credit. That is that you see credit sector deterioration that goes from downgrades to defaults, and then you have the recession afterwards. So it's sort of like this is happening before, and then the recession happens. I think that we're seeing downgrades of the junkiest of junk bonds right now, and that could be a precursor of, you know, more credit stress going forward. So to the degree we have you know, more coronavirus in the fall and the winter, we also have a default wave. You know, think about Rao's unfolding thesis, and this downgrade wave turns into a default wave, and it goes from the junkiest of the junk up the chain in terms of credit. To me, that's the time when you have to say, okay, now we're at a second period of potential volatility and downside risk, but we're not there quite yet. So that's sort of a more macro view of this whole moving from September, October to an indefinite period in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's an incredibly important point. It's good to go from downgrades to defaults rather than from defaults to downgrades as we saw in the 2008 cycle.
Right, yeah.
I suppose it's never good to go, but it's better at least to have the warning and to get something of an indicator in what's happening, as you say, in the junkiest of junk, before that moves up the credit spectrum.
Yeah, and you know, one last thing on that too is that from my perspective, the most important factor is how far is the Fed willing to go? No one knows the answer to that, because at the end of the day, they've said that they're willing to do junk ETFs. They haven't said they're looking for individual names in the junk space. They haven't said that they're willing to buy, stocks. But who knows? That could be coming. So in terms of does the Fed have your back, that's an important point. If it gets to that point where we're again at the point like March where the Fed has to get in there and say, we've got your back, you know, we'll already have had the downside risk. It will have the Fed will only get your back after the market falls apart, not before. So I think that's something to remember as well.
Yeah, some would say that's the key question, really, in terms of the degree of intervention that the Fed is willing to take. And the history of the last 10 years or so has only been in one direction, toward taking greater and greater steps to support markets.
Yeah, and the reason is because, starting with Ben Bernanke, the learning of the Great Depression is don't let it happen. Intervene at all costs, if possible, as early as possible, to prevent a meltdown, a cascade down of the Irving Fisher type of depression, where what's the word that Irving Fisher uses?
Debt deflation spiral.
Exactly. So that's what they're trying to prevent. And so all of the machinations of the Fed are geared in that direction.
Yeah, and I would also add that some of the challenge that we see, some of the reason that we see so much Fed activity is because of dysfunction in other areas of government. The Fed it's like the police. They answer the phone when you dial 911. And there are probably a lot of things that would be far better off if it weren't the police responding. But at the end of the day, somebody has to take action. So the Fed is stuck doing it. Go ahead, Ed. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, I'm 100% with you. I mean, it goes back to what I was saying before about the monetary base and then the rest of the economy. The Fed really, they've decided that if there's going to be no stimulus because we have divided government, we can't come together on stimulus, they have a dual mandate to deal with. And so they're going to have to step into the breach. They don't necessarily want to. Powell was saying, get at it, you in Congress. But Congress didn't get at it. So what's the Fed going to do now? Are they just going to stand there with their, sit on their hands? No, they're going to take action in all probability. That means more stimulus.
That's right. That's exactly right. And if we compare the remarks that Chairman Powell made at the beginning of his term to where he is today, that's absolutely the case. It's almost like, the electrical inspector goes on strike and the fire department is the one that has to show up at 3 o'clock in the morning when the building is on fire. They're not just going to let it burn down. And I think that's the position, the unenviable position, I should add, that the Fed is in.
So, honestly, I think that this is a great part of the AMA today. I don't know how it morphed into us talking about the Fed, but, ultimately, it's very important when you take a look forward as to thinking about what's going to happen, is this a sustainable recovery that we're in now? And if it's not, what are the likely outcomes? How is the Fed going to be involved? That's definitely the $64,000 question. And I believe that question will eventually be answered in the affirmative or the negative at some point in time.
Yeah, you and I are a lot of fun at cocktail parties because it always morphs into a conversation about the Fed.
Hey, before we end this, by the way, we do have a few more soccer questions, football questions there. Yeah. Let's not take them at all, but because I know some people aren't really as keen on the soccer as other people. But you got to show your druthers here. What's your team? Pick a team. I was thinking that you were a Tottenham fan. Who's your team now, Ash?
Yeah, I've been Tottenham Hotspur. I've been watching the Amazon show, I think it is, where they go live into the locker room and on the field and follow the players of Tottenham Hotspur. And it's really interesting. I think it gives you a sense of the inside culture, what it's like to be in a football club and to actually understand what it's like. And it brings you the narrative and the context. In fact, they do for soccer, for football, what we do for markets at Real Vision, right? Bring you inside and get you the sense of the culture and what people are really talking about. So sure, I'm a Tottenham fan. Let's call it that.
Excellent. I think that's a great way to end it, Ash. I don't know if you have any more, but great to know that you're finally called out on Tottenham.
I'm working on it, man.
All right, then, Ash. I think that's it. We're out of here. Let's post it on Monday.
Enjoy the holiday, everyone. Thanks for joining us, Ed.